So nice to have you back, Colin.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me again.
My pleasure. And let's get started with what's going on right now in the Middle East, the new escalations between Hezbollah and Israel. And let's start with this new type of bombings, these pagers, walkie-talkies, electronic devices. How did you find it?
Well, I don't want to discuss the nitty-gritty and the technical aspects of that, because this has been discussed by several experts, and I'm not sure we know even all the details of how this happened and how the Israeli could make that happen. But looking at just the principle and the principles and the way the attack was conducted, the interesting aspect is that this was obviously an indiscriminate type of attack, meaning they use booby-trapped pagers and walkie-talkies to basically attack an indefinite type of structure. And that's important, because when we read the papers and the media, when we see the media, they tend to say, well, they attacked a terrorist organization. And you had so many victims. I mean, the New York Post had this fantastic cover page, beep, beep, boom. You know, that was, in my view, a very bad taste type of journalism, which is, by the way, indicative of the way journalists today understand information. So, but that's something for itself. I don't want to discuss that today, but it's interesting to note. But interestingly, in the same cover page, as well as on others, by the way, they said there are 2,800 Hezbollah people wounded or whatever, terrorists. And they mentioned terrorists. And that's where we have the first question mark, because when you use such kind of attack using booby-trapped system that can be used by anybody, by the way, and we can even check if we look at the structure of the Hezbollah, because when we talk about Hezbollah, people tend to see the fighters and, you know, a fighting force and something that is bound to war. But in reality, when you look at the structure, I will show you here the structure of the Hezbollah, hoping that this works. And, I have to check the English version of that. Here it is. Here we go. Can you see that? So when you see the structure of the Hezbollah, you'll see, first of all, Hezbollah is a party. It's a political party, essentially. It's a party that has as objective the departure of all Israeli forces from Lebanese territory, period. It's not about invading Israel. It's not about taking over territory in Israel or things like that. It's about recovering the territory that belongs to Hezbollah or to Lebanon, and that was taken over by Israel since 1982. And for that, you have this structure. And as you see, you have a large part of Hezbollah is based on civilian structures. And you have the Jihad Albina, for instance, which is an organization designed to rebuild the destruction caused by Israel. And if you have here just an example of that, note that this was taken not from Hezbollah propaganda, but from the Israeli Center for Information on Terrorism. So these pictures come from the Israeli website. And you see the type of work that the Jihad al-Bina is doing. By the way, jihad that we tend to translate as holy war is in fact means in Arabic, that means effort, resistance. That's the translation of jihad. And we have here its illustration in that kind of activities where they provide water for communities, they rebuild distractions, and so on. Here you have some Hezbollah individuals with the UN peacekeepers planting trees in the southern part of Lebanon. And so we see that we have something that is very far away from the type of picture that we have in our mind regarding terrorist activities or things like that. And beside this, you have a variety of institutions, such as the Islamic Health Authority, for instance, which is dedicated to the civil protection. Basically, these are the guys that provide ambulance services. They provide support in case of flooding, in case of natural catastrophe, and all that. So they are plain civilians, and so on and so forth. I don't want to go in every detail, but the main thing is that when we talk about Hezbollah, we talk also about this structure. By the way, if you look at the way, for instance, European Union defines, the European Union has put Hezbollah on the terrorist list. But in reality, what they do is just to put the military structure onto the terrorist list. All other structures are not on the terrorist list. Meaning that when, and remember that the beepers and this kind of equipment, the talkie-walkie, which are not really provided with the strong encryption capabilities and so on. So these equipment, beepers and talkie-walkies, are used by first responders. So basically, we are talking about the main users in Hezbollah of these equipments are in the civilian structures. Military structures rely on other type of equipment. And it's also interesting to see that after the attack with the beepers and talkie-walkies, the Israeli forces had to come back with air raids against the head of the so-called Redwan force, which is a kind of a special force of Hezbollah, which belongs obviously to the military structure, because these were not harmed by the beepers and talkie-walkies. So the talkie-walkies and beepers, in fact, affected almost exclusively the civilian structures. And that's the reason why in his address, Hassan Nasrallah mentioned that his military structures were not affected. Of course, the Hezbollah as a structure was affected because of the civilians who belong to Hezbollah, but in civilian structures. And that illustrates the whole issue of using this type of attack, which is, in fact, totally indiscriminate. And that there were some discussions in the on the media, and you had these the UN also mentioned the violation of international law. And why is it a violation of international law? Because there is also something which strikes me, that when it comes, because no European or Western countries has in fact condemned the Israeli attack. And that shows that for the West, when you attack terrorists or people deemed as terrorists, even if they are not, but because terrorism is a word. Remember, and probably we can come back to this later, but the word terrorism has no official international definition. Everyone can define terrorists as he wants. I remember when I wrote my first book on terrorism and I made an encyclopedia of terrorist movements, and that was in the late 90s. At this time, you had something like 400 different definitions of terrorism, even within the United States, about 400 different definitions. So, you know, the problem is that terrorism can be anything that you don't like. And that's the reason why, by the way, when we talk about the 7th of October, 2023, serious experts prefer to talk about war crimes than terrorist acts, because a terrorist act is undefined. There's absolutely nothing that defines what is terrorist, while a war crime is defined. And you can punish with the use of international humanitarian law, you can punish a war crime, but you cannot really punish terrorism since there is no accepted definition. As a result, when you use the word terrorism, this is the open door to arbitrary type of condemnation, an arbitrary type of punishment. And that's the reason why in the West we tend to use increasingly the word terrorist, because so you can do whatever you want. Because we don't like terrorists, we'd write, by the way. But the fact of the matter is that when you use that term, then everything is open and everything is allowed. And when you say that the Hezbollah as a terrorist organization was touched by this operation, then everybody accepts it because they are terrorists. So you can accept everything. And remember that in law, it can be national criminal law or international criminal law or international law, you can never justify a crime by another crime. It's not because someone has performed a crime that you are allowed to perform a crime against the person, because that would be then the return to very primitive form of justice that we had probably 5,000 years ago with the so-called Italian law, that eye for eye and teeth for teeth or tooth for tooth and things like that. So you, this kind of thing. But in modern law, we don't accept this, and we have what we call the rule of law, and that's what defines a democratic state, by the way. It's the application of the rule of law. Now, when a state doesn't apply the rule of law, as we have with Israel, then you can ask yourself whether the word democracy is still relevant, you know, because the fundamental issue here is the rule of law. And so we see that the use of these booby-trapped communication device, in fact, goes against a lot of different conventions and laws, international laws, and in particular, the protocol on the prohibition or restriction on the use of mine booby-traps and other devices, which has been signed by Israel. And that prohibits the use of booby traps and devices in the form of apparently harmless portable devices. So we see that here we have a blatant violation of international law here. And here we also have to understand how this operation was launched. I mean, I'm not in the secret of the Israeli General Staff, but apparently it is so that this operation was planned months ago for the case Israel would attack the southern Lebanon. And in the process, in the first hours of such an attack, then they would have launched this unconventional form of attack, if you want, in order to disrupt the command and control structures of Hezbollah. Assuming that these devices were used by the leadership of the Hezbollah, then, of course, if you make all these systems explode, creating wounded or killed individuals, then that would have allegedly created a severe disruption of the command and control structure. That was the idea. But it appears that very recently, and that was probably indicated by several declarations of Nasrallah to the Israeli, that the Hezbollah started to feel that something like this operation was ongoing, and that the Israelis had the opportunity to provide some leaders of the Hezbollah with booby-trapped equipment. And that means, by the way, that the Hezbollah has a very good intelligence service, because they were probably not able to identify the problem on time to avoid it, but they anticipated that it would be done. And on their side, the Israelis felt that this project or this planned operation was about to be revealed. And therefore, they decided to trigger the whole operation without or disconnected from a land operation. And in fact, they haven't been able to launch the military operation so far. So that means that from a legal point of view, if you want, had Israel launched this beeper operation in the framework of a land operation, you could have assumed that it was part of the military operation, so with a concrete objective, a military objective related to military operation. But by disconnecting this operation with the military land operation, the physical operation, if you want, Israel, in fact, transformed that operation into a terrorist operation, because then there is no objective. The objective is simply to kill or to harm or to wound, but there is no operational link to, or there is no military advantage of doing that. Because, and I would even say that on the opposite, because what by creating such a situation, Hezbollah will be more cautious in the future, will probably change its whole first responder alert system using other equipment. They will probably change their security procedures. They will probably change some procedures in the command and control system. So meaning that launching this operation now has absolutely no military objective. It was only to kill. That was the issue. And now, if we look at this operation in as it was conducted by the Israeli, in the perspective of the international humanitarian law, or the law of war, if you prefer, Then we have to see this a very that the Israeli violated the three fundamental and main principles of international law. The first one, and I have mentioned that, I think, on your channel, those fundamental principles, because, in fact, they don't apply only in the case of these beepers and what happened in Lebanon last week, but it also applies to what Israel is doing in the Gaza Strip, for instance, by using a disproportionate type of weaponry, like bombs or 2,000-pound bombs, just to kill one or a couple of Hamas combatants. So this is disproportionate. And here we have those three principles. The first one is a principle of distinction, that you have to be able to distinguish between civilians and combatants. And you should then use the proper weapon that allows you to kill the combatants, but not the civilians. And so this is this you need to be able to discriminate between civilian and combatant. By not applying this principle, you use and using indiscriminate weapon. That's exactly what we have seen by using these beepers. Then a second principle, which is very relevant for this particular case, is the principle of proportionality. It is assumed that when you are at war, you cannot always prevent killing civilians or wounding civilians. But you should weigh the proportionality of the civilians you will harm and your military objective. And in that particular case, since there was no military objective, then the principle of proportionality was totally 100% violated, because there was absolutely, it was only, there was no proportion between the damage caused and a military objective, since there was no objective, military objective. It was a mere idea of harming the Lebanese population. And the third element is this is a precaution, the principle of precaution or caution, that when you're not able to discriminate between civilian and combatant, which may be the case, and which might be the case, especially when you are doing counterinsurgency warfare. It's very difficult to distinguish between combatant and civilians, because, as Mao Zedong used to say, the guerrilla is in the population as a fish is in water. And as a result, it's very, very difficult to make the distinction. But the principle of international law says that when in doubt, then abstain of using your weapon. So we are here in a particular case. It's almost a school case of violation of international law. In addition to that, since it affects indiscriminately combatant or non-combatant population, I mean people in first responders or people in buses or train or whatever, just think one minute that this could have happened to people in airplanes, you know? And that would have suddenly taken a completely different dimension. And we can see that some airlines today, the Lebanese one, the Al-Qatar, and probably others, they are now prohibiting the use of pagers and talkie-walkies, or the possession of pagers and talkie-walkies inside of airline flights. Meaning that today we are introducing security measures not because of terrorists, but because of a state. a so-called democratic state that creates the conditions of having some kind of counter-terrorist measures. And that says it all, you see? And I think this is a very interesting situation. And I wonder, but the problem is that the West is not, self-critic to itself to understand that. But we have here a blatant example of a state that claims to be the only democratic state in the Middle East, by the way, and the only one that creates a situation that requires counter-terrorist measures. If you add to this the different procedures that are ongoing against Israel at the International Court of Justice or the International Criminal Court, we have a picture of Israel that, in my view, doesn't incite to be allied to such a country. Because at one point, those who support, not just politically, but also physically, but by providing weapons, by providing training, by providing capabilities to Israel, might well become them also themselves also accomplice of war crimes and maybe at one point genocide if the International Court of Justice decides so. So that puts Israel in a totally different light, in my view. And for that reason, I think it's very important. We knew that Israel was not abiding by the international law. We know that since 35 years or so. And that was even reinforced and confirmed by the International Court of Justice on the 19th of July, who requested Israel to leave the occupied territories and to remove any militaries from these areas. By the way, this was also confirmed by the decision of the General Assembly of the the vote of the UN General Assembly on the International Court of Justice advisory that was just done the day Israel was performing the second wave of attacks with those walkie-talkies. And it's interesting to see that we have, in those who are against this advisory, you have the usual culprits like the U.S. And the all the his servant states, because I wonder if those states can still deserve the name of state. You have, of course, Israel, but you have Tuvalu, Tonga, and this kind of micro state of the Pacific, who basically are just servants of the U.S. But then you have all those who have abstained, basically Western countries, and the rest of the world. And here, when we talk about the rest of the world, we're talking about 124 countries. So that about two-thirds of the world community that in fact supported the advisory of the ICG. So we have here a situation where Israel has lost most of the international support. And even if you have some client states like the European states and things like this, who still don't dare to say what they want. And by the way, they fight a war in Ukraine to defend the values and principles of the West. And at the same time, when those values and same principles are harmed by Israel, nobody reacts. So we see here and that's probably all the reason that may explain and be the reason why the rest of the world doesn't take the West seriously, because we have so much double standard of everything, and we accept terrorism on certain situations, and we don't accept terrorism in others. I mean, if we talk about the issue of terrorism, it's interesting when we talk about the Hezbollah, for instance. Hezbollah was it's in French, but I think everybody will understand. Hezbollah was considered as the author of the attack against the U.S. Marine barracks in Beirut in October 1983. And what is interesting in that situation is that one of my friends is an Italian officer, is colonel, by the way. And he was in Beirut at that time because you had a multinational force created to bring peace in the context of the you had Palestinian factions, Lebanese factions, and the Israeli army at that time. So we had a very troubled situation, and you had this multinational force composed by French troops, U.S. troops, and Italian troops, and they all had the barracks close to each other. You had the French, the Italian, and the U.S. barracks. The Italians were in the middle. On that day of the 23rd of October, 1983, you had two simultaneous attacks on the French barracks and on the U.S. barracks, but none on the Italian barracks. So it was not against the West. It was not against the Westerners. There's another explanation for that. And the explanation for that is that both the French and the US didn't respect the mandate they were in Lebanon for, and namely to support peace. Both armed forces, or a contingent, started to take side for the Christians and fight and provide some reconnaissance. The French, for instance, provide some reconnaissance for the Lebanese forces, and the U.S. bombed, the multinational force, the contingent of the multinational force, cooperated with the U.S. forces and the U.S. Navy in particular to bomb some positions of the Islamic forces. As a result, both the U.S. and the French, instead of keeping their mandate of trying to establish peace and to be an interposition force, they took side and participated to the conflict. While the Italians, they stick to their mandate, didn't want to take side, and tried to handle both sides on the same footing, and for that reason they were not harmed. Now, those bombing The French in the US attribute that to Hezbollah. I remember very well because I was in the intelligence at that time, and this particular situation was worrying us because we were worried about the situation in the Middle East, obviously. And I remember perfectly that nobody mentioned Hezbollah at that time. Hezbollah was not existent. It was not a political force. Maybe some individuals had the idea of creating one, but there was absolutely no. And now no organization named Hezbollah or similar name claimed that those bombings. In fact, the bombings were claimed by completely different organizations. And in 2001, cursor. In 2001, a former defense secretary, Caspar Weinberger, who used to be the defense secretary at the time of the bombing in Beirut, and he was interviewed in September 2001, after obviously the 11th of September, and he was asked if there was any progress on the bombing of Beirut. And what he says is that we still don't know who attacked the barracks in Beirut. And we didn't know at that time because, as I said, nobody really, we never had, let's say, serious claiming serious claim on this attack. So even in 2001, nobody knew, and nota bene, he doesn't mention Hezbollah. So the Hezbollah has never been associated with that bombing. In fact, it's a myth that we tend to continue to have in order to put the label terrorist on Hezbollah. But there is absolutely no indication whatsoever that Hezbollah, which by the way was created in 1985, and that's when Hezbollah had its charter published, and the organization was then created with the publication of this charter. And that was 2 years after the bombing of, but it's convenient to mention Hezbollah as a terrorist organization. And we can go even further because I mentioned briefly the issue of the European Union considering Hezbollah as a terrorist organization. Now, since when does the EU consider Hezbollah as a terrorist organization? Since 2012. So why 2012? Since we are talking about the barracks of Beirut and all that. It was in 2012 because in 2012 you had an attack in the port of Burgas in Bulgaria. And the Israelis immediately said it was Hezbollah who performed this attack. In fact, it seems it's an attack that happened between different factions of the Israeli mafia in Bulgaria. The Israeli mafia is very strong in Bulgaria, and that was probably the internal feud between factions of the mafia. But anyway, the Israeli government came and saying it's Hezbollah. And therefore, the European Union said, okay, since it's the Hezbollah, then we put Hezbollah on the terrorist list of the EU. But incidentally, a few years later, the prosecutor in Bulgaria discovered that, in fact, the Hezbollah was not part of this whole thing. And he removed the Hezbollah from the documents, the chart, the I don't know the technical term for that, but there is a some charges, and the Hezbollah was removed from that issue.
It was some sort of indictment.
Indictment, exactly, from the indictment, exactly. They removed the Hezbollah from the indictment. But then you would assume that since it was acknowledged by a European prosecutor that Hezbollah was not part of this issue, then was innocent of that, then that the EU would reverse its decision. But not, it didn't. So that shows you how we apply our rules. You know, it goes one way, but never the other way around. And that's exactly what makes our values, our political decision, or everything we claim we are fighting for, that all that is put in doubt by the rest of the world because we are not consistent. I could accept, let's say, that you make a wrong decision based on a wrong information. But then when the information comes explaining that your decision was based on false information, then you would reverse your decision. But no, we are not doing that. Meaning that we are not credible. We don't have a credible set of values. And that's exactly because today, coming back to this cover page of the New York Post, when you say that 2,800 terrorists have been touched by these beepers and all that, that shows exactly the kind of ignorance in which we are. And especially the journalists, because these are the guys who, in fact, are shaping our perception of the world. And you see, and I see that daily, in the Swiss press, or these guys, and in the French press, it's even worse in France, by the way. There's an incredible level of ignorance among the journalists. The media is a structure that has all these journalists, but these guys who are the backbone of the media are extremely ignorant, extremely intellectually weak. And that's exactly what this example shows with the beepers. Because instead of going back to the principles, the issues what we are fighting for, and the what we claim we are fighting for in everywhere in the world. But it's not that. We are not fighting for values. We are fighting for interests, and we just adapt the values to the interests. But we have no values. We have no values anymore. We are just packaging our interests with values. That's all. And that's the reason why I think this incident with the pagers, attack with pager is extremely important in the sense that it illustrates the weakening West, the weakening of the judicial institutions, the weakening of the political institutions in the West, and the increasing lack of credibility we have in the rest of the world.
Yeah. Kamal, the other thing when it comes to this strategy right now, Netanyahu is talking about sending these people, Israeli people, to the northern part of Israel right now. Do you think with all that said, with all these attacks that on their part, is that possible?
What is possible?
To send their people to the northern part of Israel.
I mean, you are talking about the civilians that would return in their settlements because there are two things. There are the troops and you have the civilians. As you remember, from the 8th of October 2023 onwards, the Hezbollah since it's fighting against Israel on Lebanese territory, remember, they decided to support Hamas because they don't have the same objective, but they have the same enemy. And therefore, they decided to provide kind of support in order to pin down the forces in the north, in order to avoid them to be sent to Gaza. That's the strategy, if you want. By doing so, the Hezbollah has attacked only, by the way, only military installation and objectives, mostly intelligence and signals intelligence and command and control installations in the north of the of Israel and in occupied Golan. They avoided to attack civilians, and in my, as far as I know, there was no civilian casualties or very minimal, and I think even the civilian casualties that happened were the result of the countermeasures provided by Israelis. But it's something that I leave for discussion because I haven't looked at it very deeply. In any case, they avoided to shoot deliberately at civilian settlements, villages, and things like that. But the Israeli government, as a preventive measure, decided to evacuate those areas. And you have now something like 100,000, 150,000civilians, Israelis, who are living in hotel in the center part of the country and have vacated their villages in the north. Now, Netanyahu has said he wants these guys to return in their villages. But this seems, I mean, in my view, the Hezbollah will not attack those people. They have consistently avoided civilians. And we have examples, unfortunately, it would be too long to look for it right now, but we have examples where Hezbollah hit inadvertently civilians. And they send excuse for that. They acknowledge that, and they send excuse, official excuse for harming civilians in Israel. So we see, and that was acknowledged since years, that the Hezbollah doesn't aim or targets, better said, doesn't target civilians and tries to avoid civilian casualties. And so if Netanyahu would return these people, I think the threat would not come from the Hezbollah. The threat would come from the war that Israel would like to resume or to restart with the Hezbollah inside of Lebanon. As I said before, Hezbollah is not a force that is organized and equipped to attack Israel. And by the way, that's the reason why the Israeli offensive in 2006 became a failure, because the Israelis underestimated the role of the static infrastructure of the Hezbollah, and namely tunnels, trenches, bunkers, and all that, indicating that the Hezbollah is not prepared to attack, but is prepared to defend its territory. That's why it has an extensive network of tunnels and bunkers and things like this. By the way, this is the same thing in Gaza. That's the proof that this idea that the Hamas wanted to invade Israel and take over Israel is completely wrong, because the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are organized for defense with very deep, deep in physical word, of the physical meaning of the word, by the way, a very deep entrenched type of resistance. And it's exactly the same in Lebanon, meaning that the civilians, the Israeli civilians, in my view, are not threatened by Hezbollah. But of course, if you have an all-out war in the northern part of with exchange of artillery fire and all that, and if you have villages in all that, you might have civilian casualties, but not by design, because I think the Hezbollah has always clearly stated that it has nothing against Israel themselves. It has not the same objective as the Palestinians, for instance. It doesn't claim the territory of Palestine. It just wants to reclaim its own territory that was defined by the various borders that were established in the early 20th century by the French, even before the existence of Israel, by the way, where you have the border between Lebanon and, at that time, Palestine, because in the early 20s, it was a state of Palestine under a British mandate, but it was a state of Palestine. It's also important to mention. And the border was once traced at this point. And then Israel has never established its own border, basically. So Israel has no borders. That's the reason why they claim whatever border, because they don't have any. And that's exactly all the reason why, by the way, the UN has asked Israel several times to define their border, to define very clearly their border, but Israel doesn't want to do so. It was a policy decided at the very creation of Israel, just the day before the declaration of independence. The Israeli cabinet that was the committee, in fact, for the independence of Israel, they discussed the matter of the borders, and they decided not to define borders precisely because they want to expand. That's the reason why they don't want to establish their borders. And that's the reason why, by the way, the neighbors of Israel have all the rights to be worried, because they have a neighbor that has never defined its borders and has never stopped trying to expand these borders.
Colonel, shifting the gear to the conflict in Ukraine, right now, how do you find it? Do you think that Zelensky, we've heard that Zelensky is willing to negotiate with Russia. On the other hand, Russia is not willing to negotiate with Zelensky and his administration. It seems that if something happens in terms of political settlement, Russia is willing to talk with the United States. But when you look at the battlefield right now, do you think that we're getting to the point that we can say that the political settlement at the end of the day would be the solution, and we are approaching to that moment?
Well, we are undoubtedly approaching this moment. The problem is, what do we understand under the word negotiate? What do we understand under the word settlement and all that? You know, the Russians have never said they wouldn't negotiate. They always said they were prepared to negotiate. And as a matter of fact, they indicated physically that preparedness on three occasions. The first one was on the 25th of February 2022, Zelensky asked for international conference and subsequently organized a first round of negotiation in Gomel at the border with Belarus. This was failed due to internal feud within Ukraine itself. And a second round of negotiations started in Istanbul under the auspices of Turkey and Erdogan. And they almost achieved an agreement, which was at the last minute prevented by Boris Johnson. In that agreement, or draft agreement, if you prefer, that the Ukrainian delegation had signed, by the way, in that draft agreement, Russia was ready to abandon the territory it had conquered. So that shows that the main purpose of the Russians was not the conquest of territory, but the issue was the neutrality or the absence of foreign troops on Ukrainian territory. That was the main issue. And you had a third occurrence that was almost started under the auspices of Turkey again in August 2022. That was once again prevented by Boris Johnson, and that was a summit between Zelensky and Vladimir Putin. And Vladimir Putin gave its agreement for that, but just before they could reach, to realize this, Boris Johnson came and asked not to do some flimsy plans and things like this. So the Russians were always ready to talk, but they noticed that on each occasion, the negotiations were interrupted by the West. And therefore, today, and that's what Vladimir Putin said, he said, we are ready to talk, but it's useless to talk with Ukraine, because if we reach an agreement, then the West will come and say stop. So what we want, there is a say in French, you don't talk to the saints, you talk directly to God, it's better. So, and that's basically more or less the principle of Vladimir Putin, that you're not talking with the servants, you go directly to the US and you negotiate with them. And that's probably what Russia has in mind, because they know that any other solution will be disrupted by whoever in the West. And when you hear the rhetoric developed by Ursula von der Leyen or the Brits, now the rest of Europe remains a little bit more quiet, especially the Germans and the French, because they have domestic problems, they have very difficult economic situation, and therefore they are not so keen continuing the war. Probably they don't want to talk to Russia, and they probably want to support Ukraine, but they don't want to do it very openly, if you want, so they prefer to keep that quiet. But the British are very vocal, and as well as the European Union. So for the Russians, the issue of negotiation remains a very, unclear meaning, if you want. And then you have what the Ukrainians have in mind. When the Ukrainians talk about negotiations, in fact, they want the Russians to accept the so-called 10 points formula that Zelensky established in late 2022. And this is the whole point, because this formula is in fact based on various resolutions that had been accepted by the General Assembly in the early 2022, just after the start of the Russian military operation, that requires some behavior from Russia, like the withdrawal of all the occupied territories, food security, safety for civilians, and all that, these kind of things. Which, by the way, the Russians are not adverse to that. They are not adverse to those points. The problem is that Zelensky has added to these points the requirements of international court and the capitulation of Russia and all that. That's something that obviously doesn't match the situation on the ground. And why should Russia accept ruling on capitulation and all that, if they are, they still have the upper hand on the ground. So, but for Zelensky, this is what they call negotiation. It's not about negotiating, basically. It's about Russia accepting the 10 points formula. And what we have today, we have this idea of the plan for victory of Zelensky. And it's a, his approach to this victory plan is exactly this one. In fact, it's a process that would lead to the acceptation by Russia of the 10 points formula. And to achieve that objective, the process is, and the attack on Kursk, or the Kursk Oblast, was part of that. In order to make Russia feel the war, and that's exactly the terms that were used by Zelensky, Russia and the Russian population must feel the war. And the idea was that to create some kind of sense of insecurity among the Russian population and to make the Russian population asking Putin for negotiations. That was the first part of the plan. The second part of the plan is to ask the West for more weapons, the authorization of using weapons for deep strike in Russian territory, the support for reconstruction and financial support of Ukraine and all that. So, in fact, it is the same idea as the Kursk operation, but it's more the rear the Ukrainian part of the process, if you want. And in order to press Russia into a situation where they feel they have to come to the negotiation table. And then on the negotiation table, there will be no negotiation. There will the Russians will just be presented the 10 points of Zelensky, and they will have to accept. That's the idea. Now, what is unclear is what is behind the idea. Because no rational expert, even in Ukraine, by the way, can imagine that the Russians would simply accept things like this. So, some suggested that, and that was suggested by a Ukrainian, by the way. He suggested that. I don't know if I have here. Sorry. Anyway, the idea was, here we go. That was, that came out in here. That came out in the Ukrainian press. So the idea would be that since the, because the problem of Zelensky politically, domestically, is that there are some forces within Ukraine that exclude any type of negotiation. They will never accept that Zelensky would go into a negotiating process just like this. So the idea could be, but that's what this Lutsenko is suggesting, that the Ukrainian leadership today is trying to make conditions such as it's clear that Russia will refuse, and therefore, there will be no alternative than going to the negotiation table, because Russia will refuse any other possibility, and therefore there will be a constraint over Zelensky to go on negotiation. Therefore, there would be an excuse for him to negotiate, if you want. That's what is suggested. Whether it's the real idea behind all this, I don't know. But it's a possible scenario, because the requests of Zelensky are so extravagant that you can barely assume that the Russians will accept them. And therefore, I think this idea that it's a kind of provocation in order to be pushed into a corner, and in that corner, no other solution, no other exit strategy exists than negotiating. And that's probably where we are heading to. But I think the situation, I mean, definitely the Russians will continue to proceed. There is absolutely no indication whatsoever that the Russians are weakening on the front line. On the contrary, they are reinforced. The Ukrainian army has less and less capabilities, less and less ammunition and all that. Even if they get the permission of using weapons in the depth of, for using them in the depth of Russian territory, this will not change much. And they require this permission is not innocent, because it's not just a permission. It's also the fact that for using these kind of weapons in the depth of Russian territory, they need to use Western data, to make it simple, to target, to bring the weapons at the right place. And in fact, it's not the authorization to use the weapon, it's the authorization to have the data to use the weapon, if I can put it very bluntly. And that would imply then that the West would be directly involved into the conflict, because then they would provide data enabling Ukraine to strike deep in on Russian territory. So there is little chance that Ukraine can reverse the situation at military level. It can probably do some damage, as we have seen on various ammunition depots recently in Russia, which, by the way, were done by drones and not by those missiles that Zelensky asked for. But the idea of Zelensky is also to involve the world. He wants to involve the West in the conflict. He wants a physical involvement in that. And that comes at a very bad time because, as I said, the Europeans, and when I talk about the Europeans, I say European countries are, despite the fact that they hate the Russians and are happy to support the Ukrainians, they don't have the capacities to do it. And for that reason, they are very shy in responding to the demands of Zelensky. Even the Americans, by the way, are more and more reluctant to support Zelensky's demands because they don't have the capacities to do it, simply. They don't have enough ammunition, they don't have the reserve and the stock, the storage, the stored ammunition for that to do that. And so there is no appetite to support Zelensky. The only force, as I said, which is very vocal, is European Union. But European Union has no military power. It's a political power, if any power it has. But it's political. So we are heading towards a situation where the political settlement of the problem will be the only solution. The Russians may proceed. They may proceed, eventually occupy, let's say, this part of Ukraine, which is mainly Russian-speaking, which is, roughly speaking, the east side of the Dnieper River, plus the area of Odessa in the south, and probably some other parts. But I'm not sure that the Russians are aiming at this. They will do that or occupy this zone only if they have no other reason to stop, if I put it that way. If Ukrainians are willing to negotiate, that will probably help the Russians to slow down their progress and then to engage into a political process. But I'm not sure this conflict will have a military solution. It will necessarily have a political solution. The problem is under which conditions. You know, if we talk about what Ukraine could have had in March 2022, or March, April 2022, Ukraine will be 100 times much better than it will be today with a settlement. And that means that the more time goes, the less Ukraine will be in a favorable situation. They tried to attack Kursk with this idea that they could have something to bargain or to have some kind of advantage or something they could portray as a victory. And in fact, many commentators in the West mentioned this Kursk offensive as a way towards victory and a defeat of Russia and all that. When you look at the area that Ukraine is controlling in Kursk era, which has drastically diminished in the last week or so, now the Ukraine forces are simply around Sudja. It's a very tiny and a very portion of territory which has even diminished since 2 or 3 weeks. So it is, we see that the Russians are not in a hurry to destroy the Ukrainians. The Ukrainians are still injecting force in this Kursk area. And that's always the same thing with the Russians. They are, and I remind you what General Surovikin said in October 2022. He said, we have a different strategy. We don't strive for high tempo of advance. We try to preserve each and every soldiers, and methodically, we are grinding the advancing enemy. General Subikin is gone for some reasons, but the strategy remains the same. So, and that's exactly what the Russians are doing in the Kursk area, namely to grind down the forces. And since this very tiny portion of territory around Sudja is strategically, or politically, I would say, more important for the Ukrainians as it is for the Russians, the Ukrainians tend to put a lot of forces into that area. And therefore, that helps the Russians to weakening the rest of the front line. And at the same time, since the force in Sudja area is not very strong, this allows the Russians to just crush these forces gradually, very methodically, and without trying to retake the territory. Again, there is a very strong difference, which is barely understood in the West. The Russians are aiming at destroying potential, namely military potential, generally speaking, while the Ukrainians are aiming at keeping or even retake territory. So the key word for the Ukrainians is territory, while the key words for the Russians is potential, military potential. Meaning that when the Ukrainians stick to every square inch and try to defend every square inch at the expense of the force, they are in fact doing, facilitating the job for the Russians. And that's the kind of asymmetry in the perception of the conflict that in fact serves the Russians. And since in the West, nobody has really understood that, we tend to support or to incentivize Ukrainians to continue on that line. And that's exactly the wrong line. And that's exactly how the Ukrainians should not have defended their country. They should have defended their country with a more dynamic type of approach of the battlefield. And it's interesting to see that some people are saying that we are not in a conventional type of war because the Ukrainian force is much smaller than the Russian one. But remember, at the beginning of the Russian military operation, when you looked at what the media said about the balance of forces, our media was saying that the Ukrainians had even more forces than the Russians, and the Russians had anyway very outdated equipment, obsolete aircraft and obsolete tanks and poorly trained officers and soldiers and all that. And therefore, the Ukrainians will have a very easy victory because, in fact, they are very similar. And all. Today, we have a completely different narrative because, of course, we have to justify that the Russians are stronger. And the main difference between the two is that very rapidly, the Russians, I mean, the Russians fundamentally, since they are aiming at forces, not at territory, they have a more dynamic approach to the battlefield. While when you defend the territory and you stick to the territory and you think that your success lies in to every square inches that you're able to defend, then you tend to have a static way of understanding the battlefield. And those two different approaches are in fact confronted. And it is, and by the way, you have a very similar approach when you look at what is going on in Gaza, for instance. You have exactly the same thing. The Palestinians have a very more dynamic approach to the battlefield than the Israelis. The Israelis want to destroy territory, they want to occupy territory, right? While the Palestinians are just more mobile and they are able to show up and to pop up in a place to strike against the Israeli, then go back and come back in another place and things like that. So they have a very dynamic aspect. So the issue is not how much weapon you have, how technologically developed your weaponry is. It's not about this. It's how you use your equipment on the battlefield. And the one who is more dynamic, who can be more elusive on the battlefield, is probably the one who has more chances of success. The one who sticks to the terrain, has a static approach to the battlefield, who doesn't understand the mobility and to use time and space in the military operations, this one is lost. And that's exactly what we are witnessing in Ukraine, as we see in Gaza, by the way. It's very interesting. These two conflicts are very different in substance. They involve different actors with different doctrines, with different approach, with totally different type of equipment and all that. But at the same time, you can see that the mindset is a key factor for success. And the mindset of the Palestinians is closer to the mindset of the Russians, in fact, even if they don't have in any way the same kind of equipment and all that. But this approach to the battlefield, when you just hit and run and take the battlefield dynamically, is closer to what the Russians are doing, even if the Russians obviously are not performing hit and run operations. It's not a guerrilla type of army. But this idea of seeing the battlefield as something where everything moves on it. Things are not static, but they move. The time and space is combined into your strategy. This is the key aspect of that. And that's the key aspect of success. And that's why, in fact, you can see on both, and you can explain on both sides why the Israeli on one hand and the Ukrainians on the other hand do not have success. They will not have success because it's not in their mindset to have this kind of approach of the battlefield.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Colonel, for being with us today. Great pleasure to talk with you.
That was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.